Hey folks, welcome to the Wrench Turners podcast. I am your host, Mr. Joshua Taylor, founder of Wrench Turners Online. And today we have a new guest. We have Tristan Pelletier. So let's get into it. Tristan, how you doing today?
I'm good, Josh. How are you?
Awesome, awesome. Great to have you on the show. Great to have you on the show. So let's get into it. Let's talk about what got you into the trade.
I started very early, and it was mostly a recommendation from my junior high. I guess it would be career coach or counselor in the junior high school. And they said something that I could be looking at going into high school was a program in Alberta called Hear the Rap program, the registered apprenticeship program. And you pick a trade.
They really were accepting RAT as the acronym RAP. That ended up?
RAP, R-A-P.
Oh, God. Okay. Rap.
Okay. No, RAT would have, that probably would have been a bad one. But yeah, RAP program, registered apprenticeship program. And you just picked a trade and you could start in it after grade 10. So I went to school in the morning and worked in the afternoon in an automotive shop, got a bunch of extra credits and just got a head start on my apprenticeship.
Okay. Okay. Now, you were recommended in high school to do that, and you started that, and you were going through. What was the, you know, they may have recommended it, but what did you kind of think about? Why did you say, yes, I'm going to accept that suggestion and do it?
Well, I didn't initially. My parents kind of looked into it, and then I went into high school with it kind of in the back of my mind, and I took automotives in grade 10, and I really enjoyed it. So I thought it's something I could look at. And started looking at automotives as a career, and it looked like a pretty viable option for me. I was always good at math and science, not so good at social studies and language and all that. So it looked like a pretty good career path.
Yeah, I think they eat me by on some of my courses too. Yeah, I was always good at the chemistry, always good at physics and math. I could eke by without barely attending class and just randomly showing up for tests and things, but. Yeah, the language and I, English and I don't get along very well. The running gag is I speak three languages: good English, bad English, and sarcasm. So that's kind of the requisites, I think, for being a mechanic. And good English is a stretch. I think good English is a stretch.
Yeah, I have to agree. I'm probably the same. Not great English either. Struggle to write some good emails sometimes too.
Oh, I look at emails like, as a mechanic, I think our email should always be short, to the point, and almost always bullet points. Like, they should almost always be bullet. If you're writing an email to anybody, now, unless this is to a customer, I wouldn't know. There's not too many occasions where a normal, even express test, let alone a mainline tech, is writing an email to a customer. But even to a customer, you want to be a little bit more cordial than maybe a bullet point, but less confusion can happen if it's bullet point and very simple. So you were recommended, and then you started. So what was your first like, and did you start at a dealership?
No, I started in a corner tire shop when I was 15. I didn't even have a driver's license yet. So it was scary, overwhelming for the first little while. I came in the middle of summer as a trial. So it was not a tire season, not complete craziness, but it's still, as a 15-year-old kid coming into an automotive shop that's with a bunch of very seasoned old guys, was an interesting experience, to say the least, for a little bit. And
it would be. Now, like you said, I'm glad at the time you would have been understanding that you're coming into a store that's focused on tires, and you didn't come in during tire season. Had you come in during tire season, knowing what you know now as a mechanic now after the years that you've been in, do you think you would have survived? Do you think you would have stayed in it had you come in during a tire season?
It would have been rough. It would have been really rough. Nobody would have had any time to show you what to do or anything. So having a little bit of experience before the first tire season was definitely a bonus.
I think the phrase is, you know, it's either sink or swim, but I think in your circumstance, had you entered during tire season, it would have been kind of like you had concrete blocks on your feet.
Yeah, it might have made a different choice then.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So you spent the first, that's first, at least the first year in a tire shop.
Yeah, first 2 years.
So what kind of experience did you feel you get? Because I know, you know, we've had a couple, we've definitely had a whole bunch of mechanics on the show, and they've had a complete range of experience. Like, you know, our good friend of the show, friend of mine now, after all the time and energy we spent together over time, Richard came into the industry, and I would almost say he's got the luxury that he didn't have to shovel as much shit as most of us did. You know, he had the luxury of being able to work on some of the more advanced level stuff that most apprentices don't get right away. Now, there's a whole reason why that's the case. Now, he had experience prior, and there's a whole story as to why that occurred. And if you want to learn his story and understand, you know, what that means to me, means to him and his experience, go back to, he's one of the first episodes, Richard Mueller, back in the first season. But he had a completely different experience than I did. I shoveled shit. I literally had that square shovel that was literally, you know, somebody had taken a cutoff wheel and a grinder to a square spade. So it just fit inside the grates, right? You could pull the grate up with it or with a claw hammer, and you, the shovel just fit inside the concrete walls for the grates, for the troughs, for all the dirt and grime and stuff. And it literally smelled like shit. And we still it was that. I was part of the first roll, pushing a broom and shoveling shit. So
emptying the garbages, yeah.
Emptying the garbages, going to get coffee, taking customers back home or picking them up in the shuttle, and just being a general gopher. Now, it sounds like you had a little bit of that, but a little bit more because you were in a tire shop, so they were expecting you to get work done, right?
Yeah, I was in a team of guys that, yeah, we would pull it in and all of us would work together, get the jobs in and out as quick as possible. But awesome. It was primarily tires on every different type of tire machine, from an old clamshell type machine,
mm-hmm.
single swing arm machine. They had everything. We didn't have the technology that we do now.
All right. Now, what would you say in terms of camaraderie was it like in that first year? Was it tight, or was it you had to work your way in? You felt like an outsider and had to work your way in?
No, they were very accepting of me as soon as I came in. They had all been there for a really long time, and I still talked to some of them years after I left there and moved into the dealership world. But it was really good. It was awesome. Really easy to get along with. They were just accepting, I guess, of the new kid that knew nothing. See, that's, had to do some breaks.
That it sounds like, you know, we had young Aiden on the show a couple of weeks back, maybe longer than a couple of weeks back. My idea of time's a little bit off, but Aiden didn't get that camaraderie and that sense of accomplishment, that sense of leadership and of not only who he was working for at the time, but the other techs he was working around. And he's now getting that, and that sense of leadership from not necessarily just one, but at least one individual willing to mentor, at least, or something resembling taking you under your their wing, so to speak. Did you get that from that? Or was it just more of just an accepting circle of people? You're working together. You're learning by osmosis.
Like, it was kind of a combination of both. They had a couple younger guys that worked there, an apprentice that was early 20s that was really nice to me. And mm-hmm. as soon as I came in, they're kind of like, oh, you can ask him questions. And they had the one old journeyman tech, and they're like, just stay out of his way. Don't piss him off was basically the thing. Just get out of his way. Don't annoy him. So, I mean, he turned out to be a great guy, and he would teach you everything you needed to know. But it was just one of those things. You just stay out of his way and earn his respect, and then he helped you.
I love that you said that. Earn his respect. And whilst he may have been crotchety, and he may have been that kind of individual that, you know, stay out of his way, once you earned his respect, he was willing to give you the world, so to speak, because you pay your dues is almost, I really don't like pay your dues. I like the concept of earning respect more than I do saying paying your dues. Paying your dues sounds like an entitlement from somebody who's been around the block a whole bunch of times that wants you to grovel at their feet. That's what I get from pay your dues. Putting in your time and more specifically earning respect means that you don't necessarily have to do the shit of the shit to do that. But listening and following through on the actions you say you're going to do, like the do what you say what you do kind of deal, especially as a young apprentice, I think has more value than just about anything that you can possibly put stock in. And it sounds like you did that, and it sounds like you earned that respect, which gave you an opportunity to learn more, maybe learn faster. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, 100%. It helped me with all sorts of stuff, and it was just, I guess I kind of put it as pay your dues sometimes. It was, if you were free, give them a hand cleaning the parts, and if you're cleaning the parts, you can probably help and learn what he's doing as you're along in the process, so.
Yeah, I did that. I remember doing that too. That first year, two years, 3 years, just any opportunity I got to watch, right? You know, watching, I remember Keith, that was the transmission guy, and just astounded. And at the time, we were doing like caravan transmission, we were at a Dodge store, and caravan transmissions, there was just always one on its hoist. There was just always one on its hoist for one reason or another. And it was almost always a transmission, and he could have the transmissions out in what felt like seconds, and he'd have them on the bench, and he'd have them apart in what felt like seconds, and he'd be just like, he'd have them in his hands, he'd have bits in his hands and parts in his hands, and he'd be feeling his, like, and you know, he'd hand them over, what do you think of that, or what do you think of that, or what do you think of that. And I remember it's like, feel like anything wrong with this to me, is, oh, it's fucked. It's like, okay, this one feels like that one to me. It's like, yep, you have to learn the feel, right? And sometimes just looking at it, it's not the same. You got to learn the feel, and that over time you realize that a lot. I think, and you might concur with this. A lot of what we do is feel. It's a lot like being a baker, right? Sometimes it's just feel. You know, you can feel the grease in your hands, or you can feel the part in your hands. And sometimes it doesn't feel just quite right. Right. And it's just something. No, we're going to replace this disc, or we're going to replace this washer plate, or we're going to, you know, it looks fine, but it doesn't feel right. Right.
Yeah. And when you don't change that part, it usually comes back to haunt you in the end. You're like, crap, I should have.
Or at least it keeps you up at night. Right. So you spent a couple years at the tire shop. Where did you go next? But more importantly, I think the why. Why did you leave the tire shop?
I wanted more. So as soon as I graduated, I wanted to be in a dealership. So as soon as I had a chance, I just started banging on doors, running around, dropping off resumes. And it was hard to find a dealership to get into. It was always like, oh, we'll give you a shot as a porter or a detailer or something. And then I just happened to walk into the Mitsubishi dealership that was opening that month. So they hired me as an apprentice, and I did the same sort of stuff. Push the broom, empty the garbages, clean the floors for quite a while. And I was there for a couple of years, and then moved on to a GM dealership and finished my apprenticeship there.
Okay. And some people like to do this, some people don't. Do you miss Mitsu? Or do you like the new Chevy dealer better?
I'm back into the Japanese world now. I stayed at GM there for almost 10 years. Almost 10 years. And then took a year off to go traveling with my wife. And then when I came back, I was straight into the Nissan world, Nissan Infiniti. And that's where I've been for the last 10 years. I like working on the Japanese imports. I just find it easier. It's just what I'm used to, but I also never really had any problem working at GM. It's just, it's a different world. The two dealerships are run very differently. They're just different product. They're all cars. They all suck. They all break. They just break in different ways.
They do all break. It doesn't matter what they say. It doesn't matter how many, oh, it's the greatest thing. No, it's still going to break. It might break a little less, but it's going to break different than you're expecting, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Every time.
We wouldn't have jobs if they didn't break.
Right. It's job security. 100%.
Even the new electric ones, they're going to break.
And they're going to break in ways that you don't expect to. I'm thinking, you know, this relevant, not relevant, watching Cletus McFarlane buy some secondhand Sandrail. I'm watching TikTok videos this weekend and seeing him post up out in the middle of some desert somewhere along with what appears to be thousands of other Sandrails or razors or whatever the case would be. And he's bought some used Sandrail for himself to go out doing wheelies out in the sand. And there's all I saw is one little small clip. And I guess whoever was running the camera went or down the side, one probably the driver's side of the Sandrail, and just zooming into the rear driver's side control arm, and you just see the weld split. So you've got the boss for your bushing for the rear control arm, and you know the boss stays pure, and the control arm pivots on it, and you can see the weld all the way around the arm just split. It's not separated. It's just, you can see the crack forming all around the us. Like, I betcha they didn't anticipate that is where it's going to break. They just didn't anticipate that's where it's. And that's always what happens, right? We see some of the strangest stuff over the years. What's one of the strangest things you've seen, whether it's Mitsu, Chevy, or Nissan now? What's one of the strangest things you've ever seen?
You're putting me on the spot. I can't even think of one right now. It's like strange breaks you're thinking, or it like,
doesn't matter. Strange, anything strange. Something not rodent related, but completely strange. Yeah. Like a customer concern, left headlight doesn't work and it's not a bulb and it's not socket. It's something completely random. Like it's a ground for the horn or something like that.
The only one that can come to mind right now, as I'm thinking, is a very basic thing. It was a flat tire, and we took it apart, and we found a complete screwdriver inside the tire.
A screwdriver.
The whole thing inside.
The tire. Oh my goodness, that takes some effort.
That's some crap luck.
Screwdriver like, inside a tire. All right, so. I think one of the weirdest things that I've seen, I think I've only seen it the once, and I don't recall any other time. I've only seen a rim leak once, and I don't mean rim leak like tire bead to where the tire bead sits on the rim. I mean an actual rim leak. So I like guess we put a brand new tire on this PT Cruiser, and because there was multiple holes in this one tire. It had already been fixed twice, and I think that they came in slow leak. And the tech who found it found a leak in the sidewall, so it gets a new tire. And of course, this poor customer has had, like I said, it had two previous repairs on this one tire. And so now we put instead of fixing it, we put a new tire on it. So that's three repairs on the same corner tire. And not 24 hours pass, the customer comes back and the brand new tire's flat. Obviously he's pumped it up and he's drove it back, but the tire's gone flat. Brand new tire. Like, well, shit luck would be running over something again. So of course I happen to get it this time, of course, because it's a Saturday. And I've had the tire off. I've had it in the dunk tank. I couldn't get any bubbles to come out of it. And I couldn't see any holes in the tire. I had sprayed the bloody thing probably four or five times with soapy water, blah, 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 blah. I don't get it. So, of course, I was taught at the time to never put more pressure in it than you're supposed to put in it. So whatever it was set to, I think the PTs at the time were like 32 PSI. So, and this was early on. I was probably just either an apprentice or not even an apprentice yet. I was probably lube tech still. And one of the techs recommends, like, so crank it up to 60, see what happens. It's like, all right, let's see if we can find a leak. So I put it up to 60 pounds, still can't find a leak in the bloody tire. No leak in it. Like, I've sprayed a bloody tire probably six times now with soapy water, and I can't find a leak. And it's at 60 PSI, so it should leak. And a different tech in the shop was like, check the rim? What do you mean? All around? No. The rim. So I sprayed the inside of the rim with the soapy water. And lo and behold, is there not possibly smaller than a needlepoint hole in the rim. Just dead center, no, not, like, it wasn't like there was peeling paint or an impact from a stone or something like that. Literally just a tiny little pinprick right in the dead center of the rim. And it's probably been there for ages, and it probably just finally popped through after a period. Like, I've never seen that again. You ever seen a rim leak?
No,
without damage?
No, I've heard of it, but I haven't actually run across it.
It was crazy. Crazy.
I've heard the myths of it, so always check the rim on it.
Yeah.
It's a lesson always, learned.
I'm glad that there was somebody else that suggested this. Like, I wouldn't have known what to do back then, but that's where one of those things, you don't know what you don't know. So you've been at a tire shop, and then you went to the dealership world as soon as you could, and you first dealership world was Mitsubishi, and then you went to GM. You were at GM for almost a decade, and you did some traveling, and you came back, and now you're at Nissan, and you've been at Nissan for almost a decade. What are some challenging things that you've done in your career? Doesn't necessarily need to be crazy, but what are some challenging things that you've done in your career that's kind of changed how you've done your process day to day? So let's say 10 years ago, before you were in Nissan, you were in Chevy, what is something that changed how you deal with your day, whether it's process or system or software or whatever?
I guess you kind of always learn from mistakes. So everything takes you a little bit longer. You always find a little quicker way to do it. Back in GM days, I was in a general position, so we did all the kind of grunt work, and now I do a little bit of everything, but I'd say probably the process I've just learned in electrical is any sort of electrical diagnosis, I always find the wiring diagram first, obviously. Check your beginning and end for your power at the beginning, the end, and if you don't have your power at the end of the wiring diagram. In my process, I always just pick somewhere right in the middle or as close to the middle as I can get and just go from there. A lot of people start at the end and work their way back. I try to eliminate half of the circuit so you got half of the work done right away. You know, it's kind of a different way
interesting.
But
I've never heard of anybody doing that. That's interesting. Should try that next time I have some. Probably be on the bike next time I have to do that, because the SV650 doesn't want to start in any way, shape, or form. So I'm going to have to figure that out. Got a brand new battery, so I'm going to have to figure out what's not working, whether it's the ignition switch or the kill switch or whatever. But in the middle. Okay.
I don't know. That's interesting. Just kind of something I've always done. If I have power to fuse, but something in the back of the car is not working, I'll try to find the easiest access point somewhere in the middle. And then if I have power there, I know that the front half's good, and I really only have to go to the back, and I don't have to spend my whole time working through the whole thing. And if I don't have it power in the middle, obviously the problem's in the front half of the car, front half of it. I've just found it saves me half the time.
Okay, cool. Cool. So that leads us in a couple other questions. You've got creative with wiring. Where do you find yourself living the most? Do you like the diagnostic end of things more? Because you were general at the GM store. So you obviously had to do some kind of diagnostic. Do you enjoy the diagnostic more? Do you ignore like the drivability? Or do you like what part of all of the process that we have to deal with in day do you enjoy the most?
I like diagnostic. I was a foreman very early in my age, like 30 years old. So I ended up taking on a lot of those jobs. I do like it. Obviously, everybody gets frustrated at some point with endless diagnostic in one sort of thing, but I've come to enjoy the problem solving portion of it.
Okay. Now, do you find that sometimes you have to diagnose the technician as much as you have to diagnose the car? Because sometimes a technician has wound them. I know I was bad for this and I squirrel a bit, but I used to squirrel pretty bad when trying to describe where I'm at if I was in a difficult position to the foreman. So like if I was having a challenging car, instead of being methodical about telling the foreman what the problem was and what I've done, because I was emotional, and this is me looking back on it, because I was emotional about it, because I had sunk so much time and energy and still hadn't come up with his answer, I'd squirrel. So he'd have to dissect what it is that I had done, figure out whether I'd actually done it right, then work backwards. Okay, these are the okay. Then he'd realize, okay, this is what you need to do now. Do you find yourself doing that more as a foreman than you do actually diagnosing the car?
Yeah, it happens a lot of the time. So I always just start at this simple thing. What was the customer complaint? What else have you found that doesn't work or is causing a problem? Maybe there's something related there. But then, yeah, usually you're like, did you try this? Yeah. They're always worked up about it. Yeah, I tried that. Okay, well, let's just quickly test it again and see if we get the same test results, because sometimes it doesn't work out the same way and it's a pretty quick answer from there. But yeah, you usually have to calm somebody down at that point when they're hours and hours into a battle that they seem they can't win.
One of the biggest concerns that some of the foremen that I've or at least shall we, because I haven't done any foreman in coaching. I've had some quasi lead technician or senior technicians that I've dealt with in coaching. And one of the biggest challenges there is ego and getting them to overcome their ego in any circumstance where, you know, it's, oh, this is, it doesn't matter what they're talking about. Ego is such a big deal that you kind of have to squash in some kind. You don't want to be rude about it. You don't want to be detrimental or arrogant about it, but getting technicians to realize that you're there to help. You're the foreman, you're the lead tech. You're trying to help these people through a situation that's difficult. Sometimes it's lack of training, lack of experience, lack of education, lack of competence can be a thing too. Have you experienced, like, you've got almost 20 years between Chevy and Nissan. How many times would you say you've come up against a wall with a technician where no amount of education experience is going to overcome their lack of competence in the role?
Yeah, I've definitely ran into that once where you can teach the guy everything in the world, but he's still completely lost just because he doesn't believe that it's something he's going to figure out, and you can walk him through the steps as much as you want. But I've never had much problem with, like, overconfidence. It's always been guys want to figure it out on their own, but by the time they're needing to ask for help, they're usually receiving of it. And if they get mad, you're like, listen, man, I'm just here to help you figure this out. I'm not here to do it for you. I'm not here to belittle you. I'm not, we're just, let's do this together and get it sorted.
Mm. The other side of that is the time to ask. And this is a challenge that I would pose to any technicians out there, whether you're a foreman or even just a technician starting in the trade. Try to reduce your time to question. And what I mean by that is you may be in a circumstance, whether it's diagnostic related or not, many of the times it's diagnostic related, but reduce your time to question. Meaning if you're in a spot and you don't know the answer, or you don't understand the question, or you don't understand the output of the thing you've just done, if you've gone through it twice and you're getting the same answer and you either don't understand the answer or don't agree with the answer, don't go through that thing 2, 3, 4, 10 more times before you ask for help.
Correct. You'll just confuse yourself the more times you look at it.
You're going to confuse yourself. You're going to waste a whole lot of time. It's going to be bad for you on so many levels. A, it's going to be detrimental to your mental health because you're not going to be able to get through it. Now you've got a negative train of thought. You could be self-deprecating in that moment. It's like, I'm stupid. I can't do this. I shouldn't do this. This trade sucks. Whatever the case may be. But in reality, you're your own worst enemy in that point. So by reducing your time to question, ask for help, even if it's just a, I think this is what I'm doing. This is the answer I'm getting. Do you agree that I'm on the right path? Even if it's just a confirmation, like maybe you're having an off day and you're not reading correctly. Maybe that's it, whatever the case may be. But if you reduce your time to question, you can also reduce your time for diagnostic completion. And I recently did an RO audit of a small store, small to medium sized store. And I audited, almost 20 ROs for every tech in the shop for this service manager. And I posted an article, kind of a long post about it on LinkedIn. And if you want to reference it, I'm going to see if I can try and remember to reference it in this piece of content that's going out. But the single thing that came up the most, because the shop was complaining about productivity to the service manager was somewhat new. They wanted to make sure they were doing their own due diligence, and they wanted a third party perspective that they were going down the right path, that it wasn't something they were specifically doing, something they can affect, but it wasn't something they were specifically doing. And of course, it wasn't something they were specifically doing. All of the technicians in that shop had come to a complacent understanding of what was and what wasn't acceptable for diagnostic. They weren't following instruction by the service from the shop foreman. They were delaying too long to talk to engineering. They were delaying too long or not following instruction from the shop foreman. And because the service manager didn't have shop experience, they didn't have another leader to go to. So because they were taking so long to ask a question, their diag times were through the roof, like sometimes double what was going to be paid or worse. For example, and one of the references I made there is engineering had authorized 4 hours of diagnostic time, up to 4 hours of diagnostic time on this really complicated customer concern because it was a current model year vehicle. So, you know, less than 5,000 kilometers, current model year vehicle, apparently somewhat high profile customer in some way, shape, or form. So they had authorized 4 hours, but they ran 8 hours of diagnostic. So they absolutely lost their shirt on the diagnostic time. And that is something that went across the whole shop. So this whole shop was running way too much diagnostic time, not listening to the foreman, not following instruction necessarily from engineering because they were running too much diagnostic. They didn't ask questions fast enough. Like if I don't understand something, I shouldn't wait an hour to ask a question. I shouldn't be too arrogant or ignorant to think that I'm going to figure out if I spend 15 minutes more. Just ask a question. Maybe you're going down the wrong path. So reduce your time to question. And then maybe that leads us into what's our last question, Tristan. What would be your one piece of advice for a mechanic out there to be either happier, healthier, or more productive, given your nearly 20 years of experience in the trade?
You know, I was thinking about this because you kind of gave me a little prep on that one. What you're just saying is a big one. Your time to ask questions, just ask questions. I'm very lucky in the shop that I lead now. I have a lot of master techs, and if they see guys struggling, they jump in with each other to help each other out. So we're very productive in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I always tell the guys the same thing. As soon as you get a concern, read it, verify it. We're going to check for TSBs and check our database of repairs. 90% of the time, that's going to fix your problem. If not, try diagnosing it. Don't spend too much time. Then come ask somebody. Make sure you ask the questions. At an hour, reach out to engineering every time. We need to start a case on it so that we can get paid. But yeah, exactly. Ask questions. Don't be afraid. Don't be cocky. Everyone's there to help everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it is that old gruff, stay away from him guy. If they see you struggling, they're more than likely going to help you.
Exactly. I think that's great advice. It sounds like you do. Do you have process in place for diagnostics in your shop? It sounds like, okay, at an hour, we're going to submit a case. Period. End of chat. Process, like a written process?
Most of the time, yeah. As soon as someone comes and sees me, if we're at an hour, we start a tech line case. They say that sometimes maybe it's annoying for the tech line guys, but a lot of the time they can give you information back that not anybody else knows, or we have a field engineer that I can email and get some more suggestions from. But yes, it definitely helps in warranty cases to get some extra coverage on the diagnostic time and speed up the whole process.
Right. Because I think, quite honestly, you know, I've had it in coaching, I've seen it posted in forums and so on and so forth when techs are complaining about warranty times. I'm not forgiving or giving leeway or excusing poor warranty repair times. I'm not. Don't get me wrong. A lot of them suck. Many of them are attainable given practice and tooling. But the biggest loss I see, and I'm going to reiterate it like I just said, a couple minutes ago, one of the biggest losses I see when I audit ROs for service managers or shop foremen or even technicians that bring me their own ROs to see if I can help them in any way, the biggest loss I see is on diagnostic time, right? We get very, very little upfront anymore. I remember back in the day, 85, 41, 00, 00, we could get straight time, diagnostic time, depending on the category of repair. That got capped. I think it was capped at like 0.2. And I'm fairly confident that most manufacturers are pretty well in that time frame right off the hop. You get very little right up front as a, yep, you can get this for diagnostic time should you find a fault.
Should you find a problem, yeah.
Should you find a problem, right? But once you know what your processes are that you're going to do in the first 6 minutes, right? The first 6 minutes, you already know what you're going to do. The second 6 minutes, you already know what you're going to do. If you haven't found something in those first 12 minutes, you need to be making sure you're covering your backside for every single step there forward. Don't be doing things 2, 3, 4, 5 times the same thing over and over again. Time to question is a big deal because you're going to lose your shirt on the diagnostic time because they're going to go, well, I've heard this before. I don't pay you to think. And I've heard that phrase said before. And sometimes it's real, right? We get diagnostic flat time. And then we get flat time to repair. And if you follow the diagnostic steps, for the most part, some of them are pretty quick, right? You know yourself, when you go to a diagnostic tree and sometimes there's only maybe 8 steps, and unless you got to take off an hour's worth of paneling or you've got to remove connectors that are buried under a carpet that you had to take a seat out and stuff for, your time to actually do the diagnostic steps is usually quite low. Are there extenuating circumstances like Wi-Fi? Are there extenuating circumstances like seize bolts? Yes. But if you don't know the product, and I mean really know the product, you're probably going to be losing the worst of your time on diagnostic. So,
yeah.
Awesome.
That'll bring me to my second suggestion that I tell everybody. I've spent pretty much my whole career in the flat rate world at the dealership. So everybody says, as soon as you go flat rate, what do I have to worry about? Stop looking at your hours by the job or by the day. Look at them by the pay period or the month. That's the only way it's not going to drive you crazy because you're going to have crap days and you're going to have great days. And the crap days will outweigh the good days in your mind if you just pay attention to it job by job or day by day. So I tell everybody as soon as they start flat rate, don't think of it as a by the job or by the day. Look at it by your pay period, set your goal, just try to achieve that. Or you're really going to get down on yourself if you have 1 or 2, 3 bad days in a row.
That's a great piece of advice. That is a great piece of advice. Don't worry about your – be conscious of your time because there are aspects, there are correct. Some stores that don't – sorry, that aren't as diligent with your flat rate daily pay. And you got to
– look at it and make sure you're being paid – make sure you're getting paid the proper hours, but don't
worry about a 6-hour day and an 8-hour day that you put in. Worry about whether you made the 80 on the 2 weeks or the 160 or better on the month.
Whatever you aim to be. Yeah.
Right. Awesome piece of advice. Tristan, I appreciate you. Appreciate you taking the time. I really do.
Thank you.
A great bit of information there. Great insight there at the end, especially. Time to question and don't worry about the time on the day or the week. Worry about your either pay period or your month. You're going to be a lot more happy going forward because there are going to be some challenging days, times, and energies and so on and so forth. So I really appreciate that piece of advice. Awesome.
Thanks for having me.
Don't worry, sir. Folks, that's the end of today's episode. So that's not a problem because there's going to be another one coming next week. We've got a 10 mil mastery coming. Watch out for that. I really hope you guys enjoy the show, and I really hope you subscribe to the show, whether you're listening on Spotify or you're watching on YouTube, folks. Don't forget that Wrench Turners now has a merch line. There is a link below in the description, whether it's Spotify or on YouTube. You can find the wonderful phrase that our friend of the family, as it were, Marshall said, flat rate sucks, change my mind, or flat rate rocks, change my mind, depending on which side of that fence you stand on. The newsletter continues to be free and drops every 2 weeks. And like always on our one-to-one interviews, a quote for the week: money is good for nothing unless you know the value of it by experience. That's P.T. Barnum. Didn't expect that one, did you? And remember, folks, negative pushes, positive pulls, and always clean your toys before you put them away.